The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Good afternoon to you, Dr. Dean. How are you?
Good afternoon, Tosca, and good afternoon to all our listeners out there. It is the last lunchtime, Doctor, for the week, and it's a very special one for me because today is my birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. How young are you today?
I am 29 years young.
Ah, okay, good.
Yes, but of course I wanted to come and share it and share my knowledge and make sure that everybody is well equipped with their medical knowledge so that they can go about their daily lives living healthy and being happier. So today we are going to touch on a mental health issue, and the reason for that is because it is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. And yesterday we had a very long discussion in terms of that, but I wanted to go into a little more detail on something that I'm seeing a lot of my younger patients suffering with these days, and that is anxiety. So it is something that we are seeing that is more prevalent in the youth, especially on a daily basis, but we are seeing it in the working population as well. So it is something that we all need to know about. What are these signs? What are these symptoms? How can it be managed? And, you know, what are the things that we need to look out for that makes it a lot more serious than we are thinking?
Mm-hmm. So let's get to the first question for today. That question being, what exactly is anxiety and how does it differ from normal stress or worry?
So this is important because people tend to associate anxiety with just worrying or just stress that you experience on a daily basis. But it is actually, yes, you can get stress and you can have worries while having anxiety, but they are two distinct, entities. Anxiety is something that is more persistent, it's excessive, and often it is an irrational feeling of apprehension or fear about the future events that you will experience. And I would say that it differs from everyday stress or worry in both its intensity and the duration that it takes place. Stress is usually a response to a known cause or a known trigger, like if you have a tight deadline for a project, and once that situation is resolved, the stress itself subsides. Anxiety, on the other hand, it may not have an identifiable trigger, and it can even linger when there is no actual threat, and that tends to interfere with a person's daily life and their daily functioning. Now, stress can be helpful in certain situations. For example, stress is what is necessary to push us to meet deadlines or to avoid danger. But anxiety itself becomes very problematic when it's chronic, it's overwhelming, and it's disproportionate to the situation that you're experiencing. People with anxiety, they will experience things like their thoughts will be racing, or their muscles will tense up, or they may just experience restlessness and an inability to concentrate or irritability. And that anxiety tends to trickle down into other areas of our life as well. So it will impact sleep, it will impact relationships, and it will impact a person's performance at work or school. So understanding that there's a distinction between stress, which usually has an identifiable trigger, and anxiety, which is something more chronic and something that is more persistent, it is crucial, because chronic anxiety isn't just a personality trait. You know, now we're hearing a lot of people saying, oh, well, I have anxiety, or, I'm just an anxious person. It's not a personality trait. It is a legitimate medical condition that deserves its own support and its own treatment.
All right, folks, of course, Base is in here. 11 minutes now after 12 noon. You're listening to the Lunchtime Doctor, of course, Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1 and Sky 99.5. In a short while, we'll be taking a break to take some of your calls and questions on any medical topic. 625-2257, 627-3223, and of course, WhatsApp us at 306-1065. So what are some of the main signs and symptoms people should look out for?
So there are several recognized types of anxiety disorders, and each of them will have their own distinct features. So the most common that we would see would be generalized anxiety disorder, and that is where individuals tend to worry excessively about everyday things for 6 months or more than that. And there's panic disorder, which usually involves sudden and intense episodes of fear. And this is what we know as panic attacks. And there's even social anxiety disorder, where people start to fear going out in the public, or they fear social situations because they worry about being judged or being embarrassed. And there are other common types that we see as well, and they're specific phobias. So fear of heights, fear of spiders, flying, and there's even something called agoraphobia, where people have a fear of open or crowded spaces. And that is something that we often link to panic disorders. There's separation anxiety disorder, which can affect both adults and children. And there's even obsessive compulsive disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder. And they were once categorized under anxiety, but they are now classified separately, and they are in a class of their own. But nonetheless, they are two conditions that often overlap with anxiety symptoms, and they are usually managed with similar therapeutic approaches. So I think this question was important, because when we think of anxiety, a lot of us just think of the excessive worrying and the fear about what will happen. But it is important for us to know that there are different types of anxiety. People will experience anxiety differently depending on what they have. So not everybody who has a fear of spiders will have a fear of going in a crowded space. So it really is about honing in on that person's medical history and what their specific anxiety type is, and treating accordingly.
All right, so what are some of the triggers and causes of anxiety?
So before we get into that, I want to just touch a little bit on the signs and the symptoms that a person will experience, or that they should look out for, because anxiety is something that manifests through both mental and physical symptoms. So we tend to think it's just, like I said, that excessive worrying alone, and that is a mental and emotional symptom. But mentally, like I said, that constant worry, fear, racing thoughts, irritability, a sense of dread, things can happen. But what people don't know is that anxiety can also manifest in the body physically. So some people will get a rapid heartbeat, tightness in the chest, shortness of breath, sweating, dizziness, nausea, trembling, and tension in the muscles. Many people who have anxiety, they tend to feel, quote unquote, on edge, or as though something bad is about to happen. And these symptoms in persons who are diagnosed with anxiety disorders, they tend to interfere with a person's daily life. So like I mentioned earlier, they trickle down into every aspect of a person's life. So it will start to affect their sleep, their appetite, their relationships. And it is important that we understand that symptoms can vary from person to person. So not everybody is going to experience anxiety the same way, well, everybody that is diagnosed. And many don't even realize that they are experiencing anxiety. Some people just blow it off as, oh, I'm stressed out today, or I'm burnt out today. And somebody, for instance, they might constantly visit their doctors for stomach issues or fatigue, and they will be fully unaware that anxiety is the underlying cause of the issues that they are experiencing. So it is important that people recognize these symptoms early, because time management is important for that early intervention.
All right, folks, we opened up the phone lines for some of your calls. And did we get into the triggers, some of the triggers?
Oh, so in terms of the triggers itself, Anxiety, it can arise from a mix of genetic and psychological and environmental factors, all of the things that we do see in every other medical condition. And people who have a family history of anxiety or any other mental health conditions, they may be more predisposed than the average person. So if a person has a stressful life, like certain events like trauma or abuse or financial hardship, or even the loss of a loved one, these things are common triggers for anxiety disorders. Chronic illnesses as well, certain medications and substance use can contribute to a person developing anxiety disorders. And there are certain personality traits that we look at. So if somebody is a perfectionist or they have low self-esteem, that will increase a person's vulnerability or their risk in developing an anxiety disorder. So it is important that we start to kind of move away from the narrative that anxiety is always caused by external stresses. In a lot of cases, sometimes it stems from internal imbalances in a person's brain chemistry, particularly when we look at neurotransmitters like serotonin or norepinephrine and GABA. And understanding the exact root cause is something that is very much crucial and is key to managing and treating anxiety effectively.
All right, folks, yeah, we do open up your phone. The phone lines are 625-2257, 627-3223 for any of your medical questions. Somebody messaged to say, tell the doctor, happy 29th birthday. Is today your birthday, doc?
Yes, today is my birthday.
29, your baby doctor?
Yes, I would like to think I'm a young doctor.
Okay. All right, let's take this call. Hello, good afternoon. Oh, lost that one. Let's try line two here. Hello? Yeah, hello, go ahead.
Hi, good day to all. I just have one question. I know the topic is on anxiety. I have a daughter, she suffered a couple of episodes of seizure. And just recently, she had another episode of seizure. We took her to the hospital, and the doctor said they think this one was an anxiety attack. She's on a prescription drug by the name of Lamotrigine. What I noticed, given her the tablet she takes sometime morning and evening, they increase the dosage. My question to the doctor is, does this drug with an increased dosage can cause low blood pressure?
Okay, thank you.
So I am hearing that the young girl has Lamotrigine. Has seizures, and she's taking Lamotrigine in particular. Now, Lamotrigine is something that we would typically use for epilepsy, which is a seizure disorder. And low blood pressure is not really a common side effect that we would notice with the use of Lamotrigine. We would more than likely hear patients they are complaining of dizziness, lightheadedness, headache. And the dizziness or the lightheadedness, it can feel like low blood pressure. But if she's taking Lamotrigine alongside any other medications, I don't know what other medication she may be taking. We don't know if that combination could be causing something within the body. But Lamotrigine is used for the epilepsy, but low blood pressure is not a common side effect. But dizziness and lightheadedness, which are symptoms of both side effects of Lamotrigine and a symptom of low blood pressure, it can mimic it, if that makes sense.
All right. Bye. We did have some questions on Monday when we had a pre-recorded program. How much water should a senior citizen drink per day and how often, example, every hour?
So honestly, in terms of water intake, we usually say 8 full glasses of water per day. But let me tell you, water intake is going to be, if we're getting into specifics, it should be individualized based on your age and your sex, your body size, your activity level, your climate, and even medical conditions as well. For men, I would usually say about 3 liters 3 to 4 liters of water per day from all your fluids and your foods. For women, 2.7 to 3 liters. And this includes water from food, coffee, tea, juice. But the rule of thumb is usually 6 to 8 cups, which is about 2 liters of water. And honestly, I wouldn't say like every hour. If you want to split it up like that, that is completely fine. Have a glass every hour and a half. That is completely fine. For people who don't like getting up in the night to pass urine, then I would say probably limit the amount you are drinking towards bedtime. But there's no set, you know, any set time of day for you to be drinking water. Just, you know, kind of reason it out. You don't want to drink all your water in the morning and then you have no water in the evening. So, you know, it really is dependent on the person and the time they have throughout the day.
Right. Now, you just mentioned about getting up in the night to pass urine. Now, getting up in the night sometime to pass urine could be a sign of, you know, other things, especially with men with prostate cancer. But if you're somebody that drinks a lot of water, how would you know the difference between, well, something is wrong and I just pass in urine because I drink some water?
So, as men get older, they are definitely more at risk for benign prostatic hyperplasia, and that is essentially the prostate gets bigger and you're going to get certain urological complications from that. And that one of those things is nocturia, where you get up in the night to pass urine one or more times. But there are certain red flags that we tell people to look out for. So if it is 2+ times per night and it is constantly disrupting your sleep, especially if it is a new symptom and getting worse over time, then that is something you should look out for. Usually when you have drunk a lot of water, and that is the main cause, what tends to happen is you'd probably get up once or twice max, depending on how much water you drink near bedtime. But if it is constantly disrupting your sleep, say every hour, every 2 hours you have to get up, that is something you definitely need to look at. And if there's any blood in the urine when you're passing urine as well, any burning, any pain, or any urgency while you're urinating, that is something that you also need to look out for. And of course, any pelvic pain, any pressure in the lower abdomen, and any systemic symptoms as well. If you are getting weight loss, fever, night sweats. So all of these different things combined with that nocturia should be red flags.
All right, let's take a call here. Hello, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Dave. Good afternoon, Doc. Good afternoon. Doc, I want to ask you about this. Fruit. Could you eat any amount of watermelon? It's like about 3 pounds of watermelon. Could you eat all at one time? Or you buy, we say, some fake 2 pounds of fruit, you got all at least with 8 cents. I just asked you, eh? Or this is a pineapple, mm-hmm. And you could eat your belly full of water, eat a trick water for a big pineapple.
I'm sure this question is about mangoes. Mango electricity, yeah.
Eat a super mango, about 8 mangoes one time, 40 mm-hmm. the mango. I was asking her, the sugar content in it, if it's a safe, natural fruit.
So honestly, when we are looking at fruit, fruit is still a type of sugar, right? It will still have fructose in it. It will still send up your blood sugar. And there are some fruits that are what we call higher glycemic index fruits, meaning that their sugar content will be higher and they will send up your blood sugar higher than other fruits. Watermelon is one of them. Pineapple is one of them. Mangoes are one of them as well. So I definitely do not recommend eating 8 mangoes in one sitting. For mangoes, especially if it's the small one, 1 or 2 is fine. If it is a big Julie mango, you probably want to stick with 1. Sometimes we don't realize, but a serving of the fruit could be just half of the fruit itself. So if you are having a big Julie mango, then that is probably 2 servings of fruit right there. And for some people, that can actually be dangerous, especially if you are diabetic. There are certain fruits we will tell you should not be consuming, especially in excess, because it will just complicate your condition even more. So in terms of fruit for watermelon, you probably just want to have one slice of watermelon. For mangoes, if it's a small mango, one small mango, one and a half small mangoes, or one Julie mango, I honestly will not recommend you going overboard with mangoes or any type of fruit. Like, mm-hmm. you should not be eating 3/4 of a pineapple. A pineapple should probably last you about 3 to 5 days, if so little.
And of course, worse yet if you're diabetic, right?
Yes, worse yet if you're diabetic. I really will not recommend anybody who has uncontrolled diabetes to be consuming large amounts of pineapple or watermelon or any fruit that has a high glycemic index.
Somebody asked here, what about oranges and other citrus fruits?
So again, these fruits, they are good in terms of vitamin C. So with oranges, I definitely suggest maybe 1 to 1.5, depending on how big it is. And this is just general advice. You know, for different people, it is going to be individualized. And I really do recommend that if you really want something individualized to you in terms of food, you see a registered dietitian to work out your proper content in terms of your macronutrients, etc. Now, in terms of oranges, yes, you can have an orange, but people like to juice their oranges and they like to drink the juice. But remember, if you are juicing oranges, it probably takes about 4 or 5 oranges to get probably half a glass of juice. And if you think about it, you're not going to sit down and eat 5 oranges in one go. That will sound crazy. So I don't really recommend juicing a lot when it comes to fruits, because you sort of get more than you need for your body in terms of sugar content.
All right, let's get back to our topic of anxiety, folks. Are there certain people or age groups who are most at risk of developing anxiety?
So anxiety is something that can affect anyone, but there are certain groups that are more at risk. So adolescents, young adults, they are especially vulnerable because you're going through hormonal changes, you have academic pressures, and of course social challenges to fit in and be part of whatever is trending at that point. Women, statistically, they're more likely to be diagnosed with anxiety disorders than men because of hormonal fluctuations and societal roles and differences in how symptoms are expressed or reported. And that's important because yesterday we had this long conversation on men not, not actually they're going through or reporting their feelings, etc. So we know that these statistics are there because women report it, but we don't know. Maybe men could match women. Maybe men could outnumber women. We will never know if men don't start to report, their symptoms or go to the doctor for what they're experiencing. People who have a history of trauma and chronic illnesses and substance abuse, and of course, a family history of mental illness, like I mentioned before, these people are now at a higher risk of developing an anxiety disorder. And anxiety is something that we will more commonly see in older adults as well, because sometimes they're faced with loneliness and their health is declining or their mind is declining. So they're going through cognitive decline. It is important that we understand that anxiety does not only affect young or emotional people. In truth, it is something that we see at any age and in individuals from all walks of life. So any socioeconomic bracket, people can't suffer with anxiety.
All right, folks, once again, you're listening to The Lunchtime Doctor, Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, and Sky 99.5. How is anxiety diagnosed, and when should someone seek medical help?
So anxiety, unlike, the medical conditions that we will see, like heart attack, etc., it does not really have a test per se. It's more of a clinical evaluation. So your doctor is going to ask you detailed questions about your symptoms, about the duration of your symptoms and how severe they are, and if they have any sort of impact on your daily life. Like I said, there's no single lab test for anxiety, but there are screening tools. So we have something called the GAD-7, which is a questionnaire that can help us identify patterns. And in some cases, we may actually do tests for other conditions that may be linked to anxiety so that we rule out any sort of physical causes of a person's symptoms. So a thyroid test or vitamin deficiencies or even heart conditions, because all of these things can overlap in terms of symptoms, signs and symptoms of anxiety as well. So I definitely would suggest that any person that has any sort of persistent symptoms of anxiety, you do need to seek medical help, especially if that causes significant distress in your daily lives, or it starts to interfere with work or relationships or even self-care. Early intervention is something that is crucial, and it is vital, because untreated anxiety can become worse over time, and with that comes an increasing risk of other mental health conditions like depression or substance use or suicidal thoughts. So you don't want to wait for your symptoms to become unbearable, because anxiety is something that is highly treatable with the right and the appropriate support.
All right, and how can untreated anxiety impact a person's physical or mental health over time?
So chronic untreated anxiety is something that can have serious health consequences. I mean, physically alone, it actually increases a person's risk of cardiovascular problems, so high blood pressure, heart disease, because you are going to have prolonged activation of our body's fight or flight response. It can also lead to gastrointestinal issues like irritable bowel syndrome, chronic headaches, sleep disorders, weakened immunity. And this is something that can have a twofold approach, meaning that you can get anxiety from these conditions, or anxiety can actually lead to these conditions. So if you don't try to break out of that cycle, it is just going to be a continuous cycle of, I have anxiety and now I have a virus because I have a weakened immune system. And because I now I'm getting sicker, my anxiety is now getting worse. So it is a cycle that just continuously perpetuates itself unless that cycle is broken. Now, mentally, untreated anxiety is something that we will see leading to depression or burnout or substance abuse, because people are now trying to cope with their symptoms. And sometimes they turn to the wrong ways of coping, and that will lead to more complications down the road. And this can also lead to, cognitive dysfunction or decline in terms of affecting a person's memory or concentration or decision-making. And that is essentially going to limit a person's productivity and their quality of life overall. And socially, persons with anxiety, they may withdraw themselves from social situations. They may find themselves having relationship problems, and they may start to isolate themselves from everybody. The longer that anxiety is left untreated, the harder it becomes to manage. So it is important, like I keep preaching, early recognition and early treatment is going to be crucial.
Right, and can anxiety mimic other medical conditions or be misdiagnosed as something else?
Absolutely. Anxiety is something that we see a lot of the signs and symptoms overlapping with other medical conditions. So it is true to say that it can mimic a variety of those conditions, which often lead people to believe that they have some sort of heart, lung, or neurological problem. For example, a panic attack by itself can cause chest pain, rapid heartbeat, breathlessness, and symptoms that closely resemble a heart attack. Similarly, anxiety can cause tingling, numbness, dizziness, nausea, and all of these things might be mistaken for some sort of neurological or gastrointestinal issues. Now, on the flip side, real medical conditions like hyperthyroidism, anemia, or cardiac arrhythmias, they often present with anxiety-like symptoms. And that is why a thorough medical workup is very much essential before we jump to any conclusions. So it is important that people understand that the anxiety symptoms, they're not just in your head, quote unquote. They are very real symptoms, and they're going to require a holistic approach to rule out any sort of underlying physical causes that may be occurring.
All right, folks, we will be opening up the phone lines for some more of your questions. I see them coming in. Of course, you can make that call in a couple of minutes, 625-2257, 627-3223. Message us, 306-1065. Also, you can message our friends at Sangeet and Sky, and they will send your questions right to us here in studio. What are the different treatment options for anxiety, both medical and non-medical?
So when we're looking at anxiety, it is not a cookie cutter approach. The treatment is going to be highly individualized, and it may include medical, psychological, and even lifestyle approaches. So medically, there are options available like antidepressants, the SSRIs, the benzodiazepines for a short-term use, and even beta blockers if a person is having physical symptoms like the palpitations. Now, these medications, they essentially help to correct imbalances in a person's brain chemistry, but it needs to be taken or used under medical supervision only. Non-medical treatments are also highly effective. So cognitive behavioral therapy is what is considered the gold standard. And essentially what that does is it helps individuals challenge negative thought patterns and negative behaviors as well. Other exercises like mindfulness, meditation, breathing exercises, they help to regulate your nervous system. And support groups, group therapy, stress management coaching, all of these things actually provide meaningful relief. So my thing is always having a combined approach, using both medication and therapy, especially if you have a patient that is not responding well to just one of them. It often yields the best results long-term, that combined approach.
All right, folks, let's get some of your questions. You know the numbers. Somebody says, good afternoon, Bass and Dr. Britz. Happy birthday, Doc. I would think you're from the South. All women in power right now are from the South. God bless you in the work that you're doing. Are you from the South, Doc?
I am from the South.
What?
I am. Yes, okay. I grew up in Vistabella.
Okay. Way by South, I can't talk to all of you. I asked somebody saying, Doctor, is zinc a good supplement for anxiety? I asked because I used the tablet zinc, magnesium, and calcium, and it helped me a lot.
So actually, magnesium glycinate is very good in terms of calming the body and calming your neurological system. Now, for zinc and anxiety, zinc is something that plays a role in our brain function and our immune health, and even the neurotransmitters that I was talking about earlier, their regulation. And it really helps in terms of our mood and our cognition and our stress response. So over time, that zinc, that magnesium, yes, it will contribute to helping a person with anxiety. And it's a more natural way, instead of turning to the pharmacological options that you can use in your daily regime, that will help with calming the body.
All right, I did see we had a phone call there. Call us back, caller 625-2257 or 627-3223. You're listening to the Lunchtime Doctor today. Wednesday, of course, our final Lunchtime Doctor for the week. So let's get those questions in. Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for calling back.
Yes, I'm the doctor. Happy birthday to you, my lady, from Lahore, right? I just call you my favorite doctor because you give me some good, good, solid advice. Thank you very much.
All right, some birthday wishes.
Thank
there.
You.
All right. Yeah, 625-2257-6273-223. Lunchtime, Dr. Wright here on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, and Sky 99.5. Somebody had messaged since Monday. I got back the message about a female discharge. If a female is having a discharge, you know, in that area, what could lead to some of those things?
So, first of all, it depends on the discharge, because there's discharge that is normal. For example, during your ovulation period, you will get normal discharge. But what happens is when that discharge becomes colored, for example, if it's yellow or if it's green and it have or gray and it has a foul smelling odor, then that becomes a problem, and that becomes a red flag. Now, the normal color is usually clear, white, or off-white, and it's thin and watery, and there's generally no sort of odor with it, and no itching or burning or irritation. Now, like I said, when that discharge becomes green, yellow, gray, frothy, or thick, like cottage cheese-like, and foul-smelling, and it's accompanied by itching or burning, or pain during urination or sex or any sort of redness in the area, then some of the differentials for that would be things like bacterial vaginosis, yeast infection, or STIs or sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia or gonorrhea as well, and trichomoniasis. So if you are experiencing any of those things, please, please go to your doctor or go to your gynecologist and get it treated immediately.
All right, folks, some more birthday wishes are coming in there for the doctor. Once again, happy birthday going out to Dr. Brittany Day in 625-2257. Let's return to our topic of anxiety. And what role do lifestyle factors like sleep, nutrition, and exercise play in managing anxiety? Before you answer that, let's take this call here. Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, good afternoon. Happy birthday to the doctor.
Thank
doctor,
you.
I want to find out something. I am diabetic at hypertensive a little bit too. But I am urinating regularly. Very regular. I have to get up and go to the washroom to pass water. What could be causing that?
So, diabetics, they usually actually have that symptom of urinating frequently. And that, again, it is just something that we do see as one of the symptoms. And we call this polyuria. This is a classic symptom that we would see. And basically what happens is that sometimes your blood glucose levels, your kidneys are trying to remove that excess sugar by filtering it out of the blood and excreting it in the urine. But sugar is something that is osmotically active. And in short terms, it basically pulls water with it. So the higher the blood sugar, the more water gets drawn into your urine, and that causes you to urinate more often and in larger volumes as well. And depending on your age, that coupled with an enlarged prostate can sort of give you a double whammy. So that is probably what is happening. I think that you probably need to get your blood sugar under proper control. And if it is still occurring, it could possibly be something is going on with your urinary system, whether it's a BPH or any other urinary tract infection or anything like that.
All right, one more question before we go back. Good day, doctor. I'm 40-year-old male. I live an active lifestyle. I run approximately 30 miles a week. I recently started checking my blood sugar levels, and on mornings, it is just above 100. Can late eating contribute to this? I eat dinner around 8 p.m. Also, is postprandial blood sugar levels more important than fasting blood sugar levels?
So I wouldn't say that the postprandial is more important. I think that we would definitely look at the fasting more. And the reason for that is that will give us, you know, an a very good measurement of what your blood sugar is actually doing without any sort of carbohydrates or anything to affect it, affect it at that point. Now, having a blood sugar level of just above 100, it is fine, and it could be eating very late is affecting it. It could be other things within your life that is affecting it as well, like lack of proper sleep, lack of a lot of stress going on in your life, because stress does cause an inflammatory response in the body. But it's still not within that realm of, you know, pre-diabetes or diabetes. If it was over 126, I would say, hey, we have a problem here. But that 100, it's usually fine. It's not impaired. So ideally, we want between 80 to 100. But I would say you are fine. Just continue making sure that you are exercising on a daily basis, and you probably should watch your sugar content and your refined carbohydrate content as well.
And for those of you all like me, never heard that word prandial, I'll have to look it up. Has to do with while you're eating.
Right? After eating a meal, yeah.
Okay. Let me see. How effective are natural remedies, mindfulness, or therapy apps for anxiety?
So the natural remedies and the alternative approaches, it can be effective for mild to moderate anxiety, particularly when it is being used alongside other treatments. Mindfulness and meditation practices, what they do is they train the brain to stay present and to reduce any sort of overthinking and catastrophizing. And the apps that guide their users through breathing exercises and journaling and mood tracking, they have actually been shown to have clinical benefits, especially for the individuals that are very tech savvy, or they prefer their privacy. And we know in today's age, you know, most of the youths now are on their phone constantly. So having that app that helps them to stay present is definitely very much beneficial. And then we look at the herbal remedies like the ashwagandha or the valerian root or even CBD. Sometimes they are promoted for anxiety, but I mean, the evidence really is mixed, and long-term safety is still something that is under review. So it is crucial. If you do want to try any of these things, just make sure that it's okay with your doctor. First, make sure that you consult your doctor before you start any supplement, especially if you are on any other medication, because you don't want medications mixing and you are getting adverse effects from them. So these tools really are part of a broader strategy, but I don't think it should replace your professional treatment when your anxiety becomes disabling and it's messing with your day-to-day functions.
All right, and how effective are natural remedies, mindfulness? Oh, don't do that already. What a stigma still exists around anxiety, especially in Caribbean or minority communities, and how can we break that?
So I think that in the Caribbean in general, mental health conditions like anxiety, they're often misunderstood or they're even minimized. And many people see anxiety as a sign of weakness or lack of faith, or we tend to say, you know, pray it away, rather than a legitimate medical condition. And that stigma can actually prevent a lot of individuals from seeking help, leading to unnecessary suffering and worsening of their symptoms over time. So it's time we start to break that stigma with education and having open conversations. And I mean, it is up to the medical professionals and community leaders and even influencers to use accessible language to explain that anxiety is something that is common, that is treatable, and it's not something that you should be ashamed of. So, I mean, we're starting already to incorporate those mental health awareness campaigns into schools and churches and media platforms, because that is key. Sharing lived experiences, especially from respected voices, all of these things can help normalize help-seeking behavior and create a culture of support.
And do men and women experience anxiety differently?
So, yes, men and women actually experience and express anxiety in different ways. Women, they are statistically more likely to be diagnosed with anxiety disorders. And remember I said because of hormonal factors like estrogen fluctuations or pregnancy or menopause, and women are more open about reporting symptoms like worrying or panicking or physical tension. So they are more likely to seek help. Men, on the other hand, they will express anxiety through irritability and anger or even substance use rather than verbalizing their worry. I mean, we do have that social stigma around male emotional vulnerability, and that is what is leading to a lot of underdiagnosis. Men may also somaticize anxiety, and that is a word to say that they will get more physical symptoms. So they will report things like headaches, muscle pain, or fatigue. So it is important that me and us as healthcare providers, we understand these gender differences, because that is how we provide tailored support and we break down harmful stereotypes.
And what can someone do if they feel they're developing anxiety but don't want to go straight to medication?
So if someone notices early signs of anxiety, but they really want to avoid that medication initially, and I feel like most people that come to me, they really want to avoid the having to take medications. But there are several evidence-based strategies that somebody can try. So cognitive behavioral techniques like writing down anxious thoughts and challenging their logic, mindfulness meditation, deep breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, all of these things can help to regulate the nervous system and reduce any acute symptoms the person may be experiencing. And creating structure in your day, prioritizing your sleep, reducing the caffeine or alcohol, these things can make a noticeable impact. And speaking with a therapist or a counselor, it really is a strong non-medical first step. And many people do find a lot of benefits from doing this alone. Journaling, joining support groups, or using guided therapy apps can provide additional support. However, if the symptoms start to persist or they start to get worse, it really is important to not rule out medication, because in some cases, it really is a valuable tool and not a weakness.
All right, let's take a call there. Good afternoon. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. When I fix my sugar on mornings before having something, I might have just some fruit. The reading is all 140, 150, 160. So is that a big problem? Another thing, I did a blood test, A1C1, and it was 7. And one other thing. My toes, sometimes I get this cramping. So your advice, please. Thank you.
So if you have an HbA1c of 7 and a fasting blood glucose of 140, that is a problem. More than likely, you do have diabetes. So please go to your doctor, get yourself properly assessed, and make sure that they are recommending either the proper medications for you along with the lifestyle adjustments, like your adjustments to your food and your exercise requirement as well. So based on the figures I'm hearing, you more than likely do have diabetes, and the tingling in the toes is a sign or a symptom.
Yeah, but those tests she did, were they home tests, or she said she went somewhere to get them done?
Well, I'm assuming that she had to go to a lab to get it done, but okay. Somebody would have had to
give her the reading.
So please go back to the doctor that would have referred you.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, I mean, with those readings, if you take them back to somebody here, they would tell you, well, you know, miss, you're diabetic. Huh? All right?
Yes.
So final question for today. That's lunchtime, doctor, for this week here. What are the three practical things listeners can do to support their own mental health or someone else's who is struggling with anxiety?
So first, practice grounding techniques. That is essentially when you're feeling overwhelmed, use the 5-4-3-2-1 method. And that is name five things that you can see, four things that you can touch, three things that you can hear, two that you can smell, and one that you can taste. And essentially, this brings your focus back to the present moment, and it helps any short-circuit spiraling thoughts. Second, you want to open a non-judgmental conversation. If somebody you care about is struggling, don't try to quote-unquote fix them. Just listen to what they have to say. Say things like, I've noticed you seem anxious lately. Do you want to talk about it? Normalize the experience and encourage professional support without any sort of added pressure. And third, you want to set small wellness goals, like a 10-minute walk outside, or drinking more water, or journaling for 5 minutes. You know, having those small, consistent habits can really create momentum and foster resilience over time.
All right, we have just about 2 more minutes there. Once again, a lot of our birthday greetings coming up for you, Doc. Happy birthday. Hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Happy birthday to our dearest doctor.
Thank you.
May God bless you. Long, many, happy years ahead. Right, happy birthday to you, Doc. Long life, and may you have a great day. God bless you, Doctor. A very happy birthday to you. God bless you with many more wonderful years.
Oh, thank you. That was very nice of everybody, and thank you for all the birthday wishes.
All right, Doc. So you enjoy the rest of your day. Of course, folks, this has been an edition of the Lunchtime Doctor Hood right here on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1, and of course, Sky 99.5. Do enjoy the rest of your day. And remember, we're here for you Monday to Wednesday, 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on your Lunchtime Doctor. Do enjoy the rest of your day.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.